in the inner tank of tank 16 was found there was observed crystallization right in the crack, and I was wondering whether there was any such observation in the tank 4 and the new crack in tank 4.
I think this is just a little bit of speculation here, but the description was that there, when the original cracking was found, the original crack some years ago, it was found based on seeing some salt crystals on the outside of the tank wall, which is typically how we find these sorts of cracks through camera observations. It's remote cam observation. They take photos and videos down the tank wall, and then engineers will inspect those because you can't get in, obviously, to those spaces where the tank is housed. Since that time, they really haven't noticed much of an indication during these inspections relative to that kind of, you know, crystallization. They noticed some discoloration, is how I think it was described to me, in the region of those new cracks, and that's really what prompted the attention. So they did some exploratory and then followed up with some sampling of the tank wall through radiological smears outside of that. That's another reason why we just finished that process in late December. And that was, did detect radioactivity that would be consistent with salt waste in the tank. And so therefore, you know, the conclusion was that there is a crack in the wall of the tank. So it's a process. It's not an instant determination. That was just concluded actually in late December. And so, you know, now we're moving forward with the investigations. But it wasn't really obvious in this case that it was there. So that's why I believe that it was probably legacy and may have been there since earlier on, just not being able to be ascertained because of they didn't note that there was a discoloration. It wasn't crystalline.
So not as obvious as tank 16.
Well, tank 16 now, if you're talking about tank 16, that was in the 70s, I believe, when they had a leak in tank 16 and emptied that tank. Essentially, it's been empty ever since. And that'll be hopefully one of the ones that we close in 2015. So we're moving forward now with the closure process in tank 16. So that's way legacy, and I don't know about any crystalline growth on that tank. That's way before my time.
Oh, okay, not before mine. thank you. Appreciate the clarification.
Okay, it's time for our break. I have 3:10, so let's try and make it just a 5-minute break so we can get out of this hot room as soon as possible.
It's up there.
Yeah, that's authorization, not the preparation.
Authorization means that you can spend up to this amount of caution. No.
When do we expect the appropriation?
So
I thought that the first
they always have the
Is that what we expect to see? Isn't that a good indication since we moved the house in the Senate? Just the Senate?
You should
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Okay, let's take our seats and get started again. As long as Doug, oh yeah, there's Doug.
I can't see.
Not a point for me. Having to be in charge. The obvious is saying, okay, spring on. If you think about it, like exercise control, which is a cyclical fall, water charges, runoff, but the server water is diluting even further, so it's getting flushed and diluted.
1875,
1875.
You get a long
trend. It's definitely a good time. Water wetting the bottom. The other thing is, you don't know that the water is a secondary measure.
I know. That's the point. Okay. Oh, go ahead, Alex. Okay. I don't know if we lost our council members. Or, oh, no.
We're missing one more on the phone.
They're outside breathing fresh air. Are you doing the notes? Thank you. Doug, let's just go ahead and get started and we'll... Yeah, we're ready.
Good afternoon. My name is Doug Hensie. I'm the Assistant Manager of Admission Support, the Acting CFO of Savannah River site. First, I'd like to ask forgiveness because we were supposed to be here in October to talk some of this, but unfortunately, we were in the midst of our lapse of appropriations. So today, what I'm going to do is first, I'm going to start talking about the accomplishments from 13, even though we had a very uncertain fiscal year 13 with... we had furloughs, we had layoffs we had to do, we still had significant accomplishments during the year. And then I'll talk a little bit about the lapse of appropriation and how it impacted the site, both from a timing schedule perspective and from the impact of different programs. Talk a little bit about the budget for fiscal year 14. We're still in the continuing resolution, and where do we see us going as far as the actual appropriations. And then I'll just finish it up here with a little bit about the workforce, the numbers, and if you have any questions at any time, just go ahead and ask me. You don't have to wait till the end. Some of the things that we have from accomplishments during fiscal year 13. First thing there, from a safety perspective, you can see, does this have a pointer in here?
In the middle, yes.
Okay. And similar to what we talked about there with the Barnwell site, we also go and measure our safety in terms of total recordable case and the days away restricted transfers. And you can see that our rates, 0.75 and 0.31, significantly below that of the goals that we have for the department. One of the things that we're extremely proud of is we had the Recovery Act project, which occurred from 2009. We just finished up here in July of 2013, and that was actually nominated as one of three projects for Project of the Year by the Project Management Institute, and that's worldwide. Unfortunately, we didn't win. We lost out to a desalinization plant in Australia, but just to get to the last three, we consider that to be a pretty significant accomplishment, recognizing how well the Recovery Act project was managed during that time period. And just as a reminder, the Recovery Act for the site, we received $1.6 billion, and there were projects in the area completion, solid waste, and transuranic waste disposition, as well as the liquid waste. So it was through most of the different program areas throughout the site. We've also talked about the biomass cogeneration facility that came online last year. And after that first year, they generated 97,000 megawatts of electricity. And we met all of the site's steam demand. But most importantly, one of the biggest reasons is we avoided 100,000 tons of greenhouse gas emissions. So right now we're having the slight difficulty. Because of the cold weather, plant took a hit here the last couple of days, but we're bringing it back up. But you expect things like that when you have abnormal environment like we are right now. But we don't expect that to be any long term. So we are extremely happy with the way that facility has been operating. Again, working with the community, the SRS Community Reuse Organization, we removed 126,000 feet of railroad, 56,000 feet of steam lines, and 26 feet, you can see that right there. And what that does is two things. One, it allows the assets to be used for the source grow so that they can actually sell these things. But even more so for us, it means that we don't have to pay to actually do D&D or to remove it ourselves. So it's a win-win for both the site and for the source grow as we go forward on that. And one of the other things we talked about is in terms of modifications to our contracts, 99% of the contracts are modified within our goal of 180 days, and that's just being able to work with the vendors and with those companies that are doing our facilities to make sure that we're all in aligned and in sync with what is expected and what they're producing and delivering. Now I'm going to go through each of the different, quickly go through the different program areas. I know we've talked a little bit before. We've started preparations for the receipt of the Canadian liquid highly enriched uranium. We're going to be processing that through the H Canyon, and before we can do that, we have to make certain modifications. Of course, do have the right number of people, make sure that we have the people, the training, and the flow sheets and so forth in order to do that. So we're doing the preparations for that. We also are processing some of the potentially vulnerable fuels through H Canyon. There was some of the fuels identified through DNFSB with us that are in L area. We've identified those fuels, and what we're doing is we're processing those fuels. Not that they are the vulnerability, but again, we're talking about potentially vulnerable fuels. We're also doing plutonium oxide. We'll be producing that for the mixed oxide fuel fabrication facility, some of the startup feed for them, and we're continuing to do preparations, or we continue to do preparations up in our HB line in order for us to do produce this material that would support the mock startup. We also have building 235F, it's a facility that has significant quantities of plutonium held up in there. And what we're trying to do is, we actually had a recommendation from the Defense Nuclear Facility Safety Board. We're going in, looking at that facility, trying to do some risk reduction activities, and then initiate a more robust project here in the next couple of years to go in and actually address the, continue the risk reduction. And then finally, one of the things that we do on a routine basis there is receive and store the foreign research reactor and domestic research reactor fuel. Last year was actually a less busy year. We only received one FRR to five DER receipts. Coming up here in the next couple of years, we're expecting significantly more receipts. Solid waste. Completed the remediation of our legacy true waste, and what I mean by that is in some of our true waste we would have things that couldn't be in there for us to ship it off to the waste isolation pilot project, like aerosol cans or lead or so forth. So we had to go into those containers and remediate the waste so that we could put it in a condition so that it could be shipped off to the WIP. So we finished that with all of our legacy waste. We completed shipment. You can see almost 1,200 cubic meters of waste to WIP, and we're hoping that this year we will completely ship off all of the legacy transuranic waste to WIP. Like I said, we finished the remediation, but there's still some remainder on site, and we're hoping to get that shipped off this year here. And that depends on the funding levels at the Carlsbad site in order to do the shipments from here over to there. And then we also had to construct another one of our engineering trenches in order to accept the waste that we disposition, the low activity waste that we disposition on site. One of the things you'll see up there, I actually made a correction in the presentation that is not on your sheet, but the salt zone disposal unit is actually under liquid waste. It's not under the solid waste program. Talking about what we accomplished in the liquid waste program, and Shelley pointed out before, we managed to produce vitrify 225 canisters of radioactive waste. We had a goal actually of 275. There were more outages in the facility, which limited that. However, we set a new record for the month of August in producing 40 canisters. And this actually is a rate that was greater than the original design throughput of the DWF facility. That was 400 canisters a year, but things such as the bubblers we've installed and other enhancements had actually increased the design throughput of that facility. And then a couple of the other things here, record production both in the processing of material through the actinide removal process, the modular caustic side solvent extraction unit, and through the salt zone production facility. And that's why one of the things we point out here, and Terry constantly points out, is the big thing that we have to have is a place to put the material that we process. And that's why these salt zone disposal units are so important. We completed unit 3-5 there this year, and now we're starting on salt stone disposal unit number 6. And that's what becomes our limiting factor, is how soon can you build these disposal units so that you can then put the material in there. And then, of course, we talked a little bit. At that time, we were just doing closure activities for tanks 5 and 6. Shelley mentioned that we've now closed those tanks. And then you can see for the salt waste processing facility, we're at 72, in October, 72% complete with the construction. The new mod to the contract has the construction completed no later than December of 2016. Toilet groundwater. We remediated our 400th waste unit at a 515. So we're continuing to make progress in that area. And then also we met all of our RCRA CERCLA type milestones for the year. On the laboratory, just a couple things pull out. And one of the things, when I talk about the laboratory, and Terry's going to be talking much more about the Savannah River National Lab, is everything you see up here, the lab has a significant input in as far as making it a success. Flow sheets for the different processes, different samplings, and so forth. So the lab is throughout these other successes. But a couple of things just want to pull out for them. Partnered with Clemson University, you can see for the highest power output electrical simulation laboratory. And then we are collaborating significantly with the Tokyo Electric Power Company to address their cleanup efforts over there at the Fukushima nuclear site. With that, that's what we accomplished in 13. Now I'll talk a little about the lapse of appropriation starting in fiscal year 14 here. But I will take a step back. If you remember, in 13, because of the continuing resolution in 13, all the way until the March time frame before we got a full year continuing resolution, we ended up having to furlough 2,500 folks from the Savannah River Nuclear Solutions from the M&O contract. We then moved forward into, and that was in April and May time frame. We moved forward toward the end of the fiscal year, and because of what the President's budget request was, we ended up having to do a layoff on the Savannah River remediation, the liquid waste side, of over 450 individuals. Okay, so that's where we're just coming into the September time frame, and then lo and behold, we have the lapse of appropriation. So as we all know, the fiscal year starts October 1st, and as we're coming into the new fiscal year, we, unlike a lot of the federal government, we actually, there's different types of money that you can have. Most of the federal agencies have 1 year money, so when that money, when it comes to the end of that year, that fiscal year, the money goes away. We, on the other hand, have funds that are called no-year money, so they continue until they're expended. So for us, we were lucky enough to have carryover funds to go into fiscal year 14. So that allowed us to at least do operations going into 14 until the money ran out. Okay. As we were doing that, because we had the continuing resolution was kind of so delayed on the management and operating side, that side carried over more money than the liquid waste side. So we actually could go further into the year with the M&O contractor doing our nuclear materials, our spent fuel, solid waste, as opposed to the liquid waste. And you've seen the budget, and we'll talk a little bit more about the liquid waste. They had downsized, but when they went into the year, they had almost nothing. So we immediately had to start figuring out what are the plans, how are we going to stretch out as long as we can with whatever money we have. So what we did was we started looking at these different levels of operation. And if you look at the next couple sheets, there's this one here that's got this chart, and then these here. If you kind of look at those together. But what we had to figure out, because really what you wanted to do was stay out of this lowest, the last level, which is basically when you run out of money. And what that is when you run out of money, because the government, the federal government, does not allow us to spend money we don't have. That's the number one rule. You have the Anti-Deficiency Act, and you cannot violate the Anti-Deficiency Act. So that's why when you run out of money, you stop work. Okay? So what we're trying to do here is we're trying to look at these different levels of operations and determine how far along this scale here we need to get in order to stretch the money out as far as possible so that we don't get to the imminent harm avoidance, because imminent harm avoidance is when you run out of money. It's basically an IOU to the contractor saying, I will pay you because we need you to protect it, safety and security of personnel and property. That's what it is. The only question is, there is no real definition. How many people do you need to do that? Out of a site of 13,000, is that 50 people, is that 100 people, is that 1,000 people that you need to do safety and security of personnel and equipment? And what type of equipment? One thing, if you, for example, shut off the electricity to the melter, and because you shut off the electricity, the melter solidifies, and you've now lost $40 million, it's another thing if you potentially turn off the heat to a storage shed and there's not really anything in there. So there's a lot of questions on what this is, and so our whole focus was not to get down to that area, not to get down to that level. So what we did was we, normal operations, and we were defining what these other areas were as we went along. So coming to this, normal operations, everybody familiar with normal operations, everything's up and running, you're processing material through. MinSafe is actually a term that we use in the budget world every year. We define as part of any sort of facility program and process, how much is MinSafe? Now, one of the things that have to be careful of is MinSafe, if you go back to when I was in the nuclear Navy, MinSafe that you define back in, say, the military operations is not the same as our budget MinSafe operations. So when you see our MinSafe for our purpose, you have, the only thing is you're not producing, you're not sticking material through the process. However, all the facilities are maintained at its complete high state of readiness. All your corrective and preventive maintenance is being performed, and you have full staffing levels with everyone trained and qualified. So the only thing you haven't done is introduce a material into the canyon to actually process it. Okay? When we got to the lapse of appropriation, we then started to develop and define a new term called safe and secure. And this is the level that's significantly less, you can see here, significantly less than that MinSafe, and it's really, what are those things that you can put off, and for our purpose, we assume 60 days. So you can see things such as certain safety analysis and TSR type of things you could defer for maybe a 30-day period. We did define that RCRA and CERCLA was part of that safe and secure, but we didn't do any sort of preventative maintenance. And the only thing you did was necessary corrective maintenance for there. And again, you can see protect property and preserve human life. And so this was the state that we took the site to in order to stretch out our funding as long as possible. Because to get down to this imminent harm avoidance, this is a term that is an exception to the Anti-Deficiency Act. It involves the lawyers. And then we guaranteed you didn't have all the auditors come in later and say, well, somebody's going to then judge you on whether you made the right decision on what was imminent harm avoidance. Luckily, we never got to that that situation. So let me just kind of show you what we did from a chronological perspective. You see the lapse of appropriation. So even before that, we were starting to do delays as much as possible to stretch out that money. I talked about the liquid waste program not having very much carryover of funds. So you can see, starting right on October 3rd, we went right down into the safe and secure posture, and that was basically we were defining it as we were going down into that state. And one day later, we furloughed 1,465 liquid waste employees. And that was just because their carryover, if we didn't do that, would have run out probably by October 6th, 7th, somewhere in that time frame. So we're just trying to stretch it out. And you see they get completely ramped down. And so they're first into the safe and secure posture. Then on October 11th, we furloughed our security personnel, 270 of security personnel, things such as closing barricades, to come into the site, deferring some other specific work that I'll show you on the next page. And they were ramped down a couple days later on the 13th. We then were at the point where we have DOE support service contractors, so those contractors were then notified, and then very shortly after that we were looking at going to Savannah River Nuclear Solutions, M&O, the rest of the site programs, had all the plans in place and we were about to go into safe and secure. But then on the 17th, we got the short-term continuing resolution, which goes through January 15th. The one thing that we were impressed in this whole deal was it took one day to get the money. Normally, it has to go, when Congress does any sort of appropriations or continuing resolution, it then has to go to the Office of Management and Budget, and then it comes to the DOE CFO office, and then it comes down to EM, which normally takes 10 days to 2 weeks. So that was one of the good things that came out of this. It can happen.
You're grasping at straws to be impressed with.
Well, I mean, you gotta reach for whatever you can get, and you know that was one thing. We said we returned operations on the 21st, but we didn't just jump back into operations. We did a deliberate approach, brought back the folks from management, started planning, and then brought the people back. Because it would have just been a mess if you just